Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard a case that started with a state worker here in Illinois. And what could it mean for unions nationally? Here's University of Illinois Law School Dean and constitutional law scholar Vikram Amar.
The basic question here is whether someone who chooses not to be part of a public sector union has to pay something to the union to help defray the cost that the union incurs in the collective bargaining element of the union's job.
And in the last of our series of conversations with candidate for governor, we speak with physician Robert Marshall. He's the only Democratic candidate who doesn't want to replace Illinois' flat tax system.
I look for new sources of revenue, and I'm opposed to any increase in the graduate tax. Our economy is improving slowly, you know, day by day, very, very slowly. And that by itself brings in extra revenue.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. We'll get started just after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's only Tuesday. It's already a busy week for unions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, graduate students at the University of Illinois officially went on strike yesterday. They're arguing for guaranteed tuition waivers and higher wages. And in Washington, the Supreme Court yesterday heard arguments for a case that started right here in Illinois but has national implications. The case is Janus versus AFSCME. And the reason it could affect unions all across the country is because it deals with, quote unquote, fair share fees. That's basically the membership fee everyone who's represented by a union pays, regardless of whether or not they want to. It accounts for things unions do for all of its members, like negotiate for wages or work hours or health care. And this all started as a lawsuit Governor Rauner brought against AFSCME. He was actually in Washington yesterday to listen to the testimony at the Supreme Court and subsequently sent a campaign email in which he said, quote, a victory for Mark Janus means the right of free speech for state workers will be restored. Despite that enthusiasm, backers for the case have actually asked the governor to distance himself from that. We're going to be talking more about that later. In other legal news in Illinois, the High Court also recently handed down a unanimous ruling that has to do with Iranian artifacts loaned to Chicago museums. There's a lot to get into. And with us here in our Urbana studios to help us explain all of this is constitutional law scholar Vikram Amar. He's also dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. Dean Amar, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be with you.
So I want to talk about the Janus case in a moment, but let's start about with this ruling involving Chicago museums first. So the court decided that victims of terrorist attacks cannot seize Iranian antiquities that are currently on loan at the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute. What did this even have to do with the Supreme Court?
So there's a federal statute that Congress passed in the 70s called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, the FISA, F-I-S-A, FSIA. And this act immunizes foreign governments from liability. So it's part of an international relations strategy whereby countries don't want to allow their citizens to sue other countries. It's a respect kind of a thing. So generally speaking, things that a foreign government does that you don't like, you can't sue them over. But there are some exceptions to this statute, and one of them allows you to sue a foreign government if they are designated as a sponsor of terrorism and your injuries arise out of those terrorist acts. So in this case, Hamas carried out some suicide bombings that injured 200 citizens, 200 people in Jerusalem. And the plaintiffs in this case were victims who were injured or family members of victims who were injured, and they sued the Iranian government. And because the Iranian government is designated as a terrorist state, the plaintiffs were allowed to sue. But there's a separate part of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that prevents you from going after property owned by a foreign government if that property is not owned by the government itself but is owned through an instrumentality or agency. In this case, it would be the Arts Department of Iran. And so Iran owns some art through its arts agencies that's on loan to these museums in Chicago. And so the artifacts are worth a lot of money, and they are here in Chicago. And the plaintiffs in this case who are suing the government of Iran tried to seize that property to satisfy the claims that they had against the government of Iran. And the Supreme Court said you could sue the government of Iran, but you can't get at this property because it's owned by a separate agency within the government.
Essentially trying to, I guess, maybe also provide some more bolstering to this kind of notion of FISA respect.
Exactly. So you got to remember the starting point for this statute is that foreign governments ought to be immune from liability altogether. So when we have exceptions like the one for state-sponsored terrorism, we're going to construe them kind of narrowly. And in this case, the court said it's one thing to be able to sue the government, but it's another to go after assets that the government might own, but it owns it through a separate entity, and we want to respect the independence of that separate entity. In short, it wouldn't be fair to punish the International Iran Arts Agency by making them turn over this valuable property.
We're going to get into sort of the politics of the makeup of the court in a minute as we talk about this union decision. But this is an interesting one because I guess this isn't necessarily, we tend to think about view decisions of the Supreme Court in terms of being conservative or liberal. This is kind of a little apart from this, I imagine.
Yeah, this was a unanimous ruling. One of the justices, I think it was Kagan, didn't participate. So it was 8-0. The key question in this case was one of statutory construction, statutory interpretation. You asked how it got to the Supreme Court. The only reason the Supreme Court took the case is because two circuit courts had split or rendered different rulings on the meaning of this Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Seventh Circuit ruled that you could not attach these assets, and so the Supreme Court affirmed the Seventh Circuit. But another circuit in a similar kind of case had gone the other way. The court tends to be less divided in cases construing the meaning of congressional statutes than constitutional cases like the Janus First Amendment case we're about to talk about.
So those 30,000 clay tablets known as the Persepolis Collection will still be on loan to the University of Chicago. Let's turn to this Janus case regarding unions. The plaintiff in this is Mark Janus, an Illinois state worker. He's arguing he doesn't want to pay partial union dues. Vic, can you explain a little bit of the history of this? Because there's already been court rulings about unions and fees and political money. What's the history here?
So the starting point is to realize that Illinois, like other states, allows public sector unions to be the exclusive bargaining entity that negotiates with the public sector employer.
So you have to be a part of the union.
Well, you don't have to be a part of it. That's the key. So the union is the one that represents all employees right now. But going back to the 70s, individual employees who did not want to be a part of the union for political or other reasons got cases to the Supreme Court, one in 1977 and then another one in 1986. The first one's called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, and the one from 86 is called Chicago Teachers Union versus Hudson. And in both of those cases, the Supreme Court said, you don't have to pay union dues if you don't want to be a member of the union, and you certainly don't have to subsidize the union's political activities. Unions give money to candidates. They take out political advertisements, etc. But what you have to pay is what's called a fair share fee that gives the union money that it uses to negotiate work conditions, wages, pensions, things that benefit all employees. It wouldn't be right, the Supreme Court said, if you could free ride on all your other fellow employees who are funding those union activities that benefit everybody. So you have a right to opt out of paying any money that the union is going to use for pure politicking, but you don't have a right to opt out of the so-called fair share fee. And that was affirmed, as I said, in 77 in this case called Abood, and then again in the mid-80s. In the last 5 or 7 years, there's been a majority of justices that have signaled that they want to revisit all this, and that's what the Janus case is about. Most people expect that a 5-4 majority will completely overrule Abood and say that it violates the First Amendment for you to have to give any money to a union that you don't want to. Because even when the union is negotiating for workplace conditions and wages, it's engaging in expression that you may not like, and you shouldn't have to sponsor that expressive activity.
I'm speaking with University of Law School Dean Vikram Amar about this Supreme Court case. Arguments were heard yesterday for this case that originated here in Illinois. If you have questions or comments, you can always tweet us. Our handle is 21STShow. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. How is this a free speech issue? And this is something Governor Rauner keeps saying also is a free speech issue. Where does the First Amendment come into this?
It's a very good question. There are a lot of First Amendment scholars, and I haven't given enough thought on this to know exactly where I come down. But I know plenty of other strong First Amendment scholars who don't think there's a First Amendment issue here at all. They think this is a workplace conduct regulation. You're just regulating what employers and employees do. But to the extent that there is a free speech claim, here's how it goes. That when you give money, you are associating yourself with an organization. And when that organization itself engages in expressive activity, as is certainly the case when the union takes out political ad or gives contributions or endorses candidates, you shouldn't have to fund expression that you disagree with, because that's like telling you to actually engage in the speech. They're taking your resources and forcing you to speak in a way you don't want. Just as in Woolley versus Maynard, they would argue, a case from the 70s, the state of New Hampshire could not require that you bear the state's motto, live free or die, on a license plate that had to be affixed to your car, because you shouldn't have to use your car as a vessel for the state's message. So to hear, you shouldn't have to be a tool for the union's speech. The problem, though, and this is important, because there's a lot of labor law that regulates speech. We ban so-called secondary boycotts that unions, if union has an issue with you and it's striking you, they cannot strike your suppliers because that's considered a secondary company. That's a regulation of expressive activity. The labor laws prohibit what employers can and can't tell union employees on the job. So labor law has always thought to be a domain that involves regulation of workplace conduct, kind of exempt from the First Amendment. And if you pull on this string, as the majority of the Supreme Court seems to want to do, a lot could unravel.
Here's what we actually have some audio of Governor Rauner talking about this. As I said, he was in Washington yesterday to listen to this testimony, as this case will have not just a big impact on our state, but the country.
Any payment to a government union by its very nature is political. All that government unions do, every union that impacts taxpayers, 100% of what they do is political by its very nature. It impacts government, it impacts taxpayers, it impacts government policy. So it is, everything they do is political speech in a government union. That's why forced payment of any types of dues, any types of fees, is violation of free speech and political affiliation.
That's Governor Rauner, that audio courtesy of NPR's Nina Totenberg yesterday. Vic, a lot of this seems like it comes down to politics, or at least it seems like that's what the plaintiffs and the defendants are making this case about. And when it comes to unions, like a lot of other hot button issues where we're talking about abortion or same-sex marriage, I think you can anticipate the arguments from the left to the right. When it comes to the law in the Supreme Court, do you think there's a way for them to separate the politics from this, or is this where we get into sort of the political leanings of the judges and how they interpret this?
Well, I think you'd like to believe there's a way to separate constitutional law from partisan politics. This happens to be a case that's likely to break down 5-4 along Republican versus Democratic appointees, and there probably is some general correlation between the justices' attitudes in this case and their views about the value of labor unions, including public sector labor unions, and the economy more generally. But you raise an interesting point, because the First Amendment and free speech is one area where the Supreme Court has tended to decide cases not on a 5-4 basis. A lot of big free speech cases have been decided by larger majorities of the Supreme Court. And so I think it's unfortunate that this one will be decided in the name of the First Amendment based on a starkly kind of partisan lineup. And Governor Rauner hit the nail on the head when he identified the key question. So up until now, the Supreme Court has felt comfortable distinguishing between a union's political activities like endorsement or donations, and you don't have to fund those if you don't want to. But the activities the union undertakes to regulate and improve the workplace, those have been thought to be not political activities. Those have been thought to be just workplace activities.
And he's making the argument that everything a union does is inherently political.
Exactly. And you can see that argument, for example, if a union's arguing in favor of pension protection. Okay, you could look at that as an issue that's distinctively applicable to the employees in the workplace, but you could also look at that as a big question of public policy. States like Illinois have a lot of debt relating to their pensions. How do we want to deal with that? Do we want to phase them out? Do we want to protect them? Blah, blah, blah. So there's a political dimension to some of this stuff. But up until now, the court has been comfortable with this line between electioneering or politics on the one hand and workplace conditions. And now that's under a lot of pressure.
I'm speaking with constitutional law expert Vikram Amar. And I wanted to ask you, as someone who's a keen watcher of the court, Justice Neil Gorsuch, the newest justice appointed by President Bush, may be a key decider here. He didn't ask any questions yesterday when the court was hearing these arguments. We just have about a minute before we take a break. But is that typical for him?
No. And he's not just likely to be the key decider. He will be the key decider because this issue broke down 4-4 after Justice Scalia's death. Everyone expected this case to happen a few years ago out of California, a case called Friedrichs. And it's only because Justice Scalia died after oral argument that the court deadlocked 4-4. So Gorsuch will tip the balance. Everyone expects him to rule with the more conservative justices in this case. He has been very vocal on the court so far. So here's a situation where I think he just thought there was nothing to gain by tipping his hand, even though people know what he's going to do.
Not even worth asking questions. Interesting. Okay, we're going to continue this conversation, as I said, after the break. The politics of this, Brian Mackey from Illinois Public Radio is going to be joining us to explain a little bit of the politics of this during this campaign year. Vikram Amar is going to stick around with us as well, a constitutional law expert. He's also dean of the College of Law at Illinois, at University of Illinois. If you have questions or comments, you're always welcome to join us. You can tweet. Our handle's 21STShow. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. And we'll pick up this conversation just after this short break.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about a Supreme Court case that began right here in Illinois that may have a devastating and national effect on unions. Constitutional law expert Vikram Amar is in studio with me here in Urbana. He's also dean of the law school at the University of Illinois. I also want to welcome Brian Mackey to the conversation. He's been covering this issue for Illinois Public Radio, where he's a State House reporter. He's on the line with us from Springfield. Hey, Brian, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla, how are you?
Vic, just to get back to that issue we were talking about before the break. So it's an interesting, the whole notion of bringing free speech into this. So, for example, could you make an argument, I don't want to pay taxes because that's a violation of my speech, my free speech rights, and I don't want my taxes to fund like the U.S. military, for example.
Right. Or more pointedly still, I don't want my taxes to fund the government advertising or government speech about the military, because a lot of what government does takes the form of government speech. And you might disagree with the government speech, but that would be a dead bang loser of a claim. The Supreme Court would never allow you to try to opt out of your taxes.
So why can you do it with unions, possibly?
Well, that's a question. And there are really two areas where the Supreme Court has said you cannot be required to belong to or give money to an organization that is engaging in expressive activity. One is these unions, the unions. The other is the state bar. So in a case from 1990 called Keller versus California State Bar, the Supreme Court adopted a very similar scheme to the one we have in place now for unions that's about to be changed. Namely, you have to pay dues to the state bar that the bar uses to regulate bad attorneys and discipline kind of crooked attorneys. But to the extent that a state bar engages in political lobbying, you have a right to opt out and not pay the money that goes toward that. So those are the two areas. The Supreme Court has never explained kind of why those two areas are distinctively important. As I said, until recently, I think most people assumed that labor relations was thought best as a workplace regulation of conduct rather than compelled speech. But that's all going to change now, probably this summer.
And let's just, Brian, bring you into this in terms of unions in Illinois. They are very politically active. Given that the court is at this point, as we've just been talking about, we're expecting that the court is going to rule in Janice's favor, given the makeup of the court right now. Brian, how have union members and leadership, what have they been saying about this case here in Illinois?
Well, they're concerned in the short term, certainly. AFSCME is the big union that represents a tremendous number of state employees, prison guards, child care workers like Mr. Janice is, people who investigate child abuse, things like that. And, you know, we've seen in Wisconsin that this really does. Wisconsin passed these through the, you know, legislative process because they had a Republican legislature to work with their Republican governor, unlike we have here where the Republican governor would like to do this but has a strong Democratic legislature that's not going along. But we've seen in Wisconsin that public union membership does take a hit. And you do have, you know, what they call this free rider problem. If people don't have to pay dues and they don't see what benefit they're getting, then they probably won't. I mean, I've talked to young union members in AFSCME here who, you know, they're not getting the same sort of pay increases that senior members of the union are getting. Some of them, you know, the only way they can get a pay increase is to change jobs. Now, partly that's because we've been in this weird contract freeze situation for the last 3 years. But, you know, the unions are sort of bracing for a decline in membership if the court rules the way a lot of people expect them to.
And from that perspective, Vic, what do we see? If we sense our unions anticipating this loss, how will they respond to that?
Well, one way is that they filed their own lawsuit. Because one of the things that unions are obligated to do right now is represent all of the employees, not just the members in the workplace. So they have what's called the duty of fair representation. So that means even if someone chose not to be a member of your union, if that person is being picked on by the employer or being subjected to unfair work conditions, the union's supposed to represent them. And now the union's filed suit saying, well, if we lose in Janus, if people don't have to give us any money, even for the collective bargaining and workplace issues, then why should we have to represent them? It violates our First Amendment rights to have to spend time and money helping them when we don't want to help them because they chose not to be part of us or to contribute to us. So I think that it's not a bad argument, and it highlights how so much of what happens at the workplace involves expression. And if you treat all of this under the First Amendment rather than workplace conduct regulations, then a lot of it could unravel. Now, there's some things that the union has to protect everybody for. For example, wages. If it negotiates a good deal on wages with the employer, then everyone's going to get the benefit of those wages, not just the people that had paid money to the union. Or maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe the union will say, we're going to negotiate a separate deal for the people who actually contributed to us. They're going to get a certain wage, and everyone else is going to get a lower wage. And to the extent that those people feel aggrieved, well, that was your choice in not belonging to the union, and we had no duty to take your interest into account. That's the kind of concern that people have about unraveling this whole system.
We also have some audio from our Illinois Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, discussing this. Let's hear that.
This case is not about impinging on anybody's First Amendment rights. The law already protects people's First Amendment rights. This is a case where there are a small group of very well-funded right-wing extremists that want to eliminate unions throughout this country. If that happens, we are going to see an even steeper decline in the middle class, and we are going to see even greater economic inequality than we already have.
That's Attorney General Lisa Madigan in D.C. yesterday talking about this case. Brian Mackey, I just wanted to ask you about union membership. When we're looking at $15 million people across the country, 11% of the workforce, that's something, that perspective is obviously much lower than it was. If we're thinking about what union membership looked like, for example, during World War II, that was about 35% of the country. In the public sector, one in three workers belong to the union. What do the numbers look like here in Illinois, both for workers in the public sector and more broadly through the state, Brian?
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a few years since I looked at these numbers, but I did pull some up. This is both census, current population survey numbers, and another group of academics who keep numbers for unions. But in the private sector nationally, union membership was only around 6.6%, whereas in Illinois, private sector union membership was 9%. So almost 40 to 50% higher in Illinois than it is elsewhere, you know, in terms of the national average. But once you turn to the public sector unions, it's much higher percentage. It's really grown a lot, too, in the last decades. So, again, this is a few years ago, but the public sector unionization in Illinois was 54.7%, right? That's more than half of the government workers in Illinois belong to a union. Now, that just a little caveat, that does include like postal workers and federal workers. And because of the way the survey data works, you can't really break it down. They don't have enough of a sample size to break it down for like state and local government. But, you know, anecdotally, we certainly know that union membership in state government had been growing, you know, at least until the Rauner administration. And a lot of that was driven by the sort of austerity. People who were not in unions were looking at their union colleagues and seeing that they were getting pay increases negotiated in the contracts while everybody else was sort of under a wage freeze situation. And so you saw unionization drives moving higher and higher up the food chain in state government.
Just a point of disclosure, I know we had a caller who just mentioned this and said we should disclose we're state employees. We are, you and I, Brian. We're not part of a union, at least I'm not here at the University of Illinois. So just a full disclosure, we are state employees because both of us, through our university-affiliated licensees, work technically for the state of Illinois and technically for our respective universities, but we are not part of a union. Brian, let me just ask you the political, the optics of this politically. He went to Washington, Governor Rauner, yesterday to hear this. This has certainly been a central tenet of his turnaround agenda since he took office to curtail unions. But the group behind Janus is sending out information saying, hey, Governor Rauner, you don't have anything to do with this. What's that about?
Well, this is the thing, right? Governor Rauner would like to be driving this train, and instead he's sort of forced to just hitch his caboose to the back of it. He had filed this lawsuit originally, and the judge said, you have no standing to file this lawsuit, and dismissed him. And that's where they found this state employee, Mr. Janus, to step in. But he still, you know, is campaigning on this as something that he thinks would transform Illinois. He's sort of hitching his wagon to it as one of, you know, something that he can try and ride as an accomplishment for him. The group that is actually supporting it, this big conservative think tank and legal advocacy organization across the country called the State Policy Network. The branch here is called the Liberty Justice Center. They're filing this lawsuit. The public stance here is this is about freedom. This is about speech. This is about a worker who doesn't want to be compelled to give speech. But of course, this has been a dream of conservatives to undermine one of the key financial backers of the Democratic Party. And that's what is ultimately the goal here, right? Yes, they believe the things about freedom, sure. But ultimately, this is meant to undermine one of the big fundraising aspects of the Democratic Party in terms of public sector unions.
Yeah, so we'll see how this all of this plays out. Vic, we're not expected to hear from the court on this until the summer, I presume.
Yeah, typically the biggest, most contentious cases like this one come down toward the end of the term, which would be the last couple weeks of June.
Vic Amar is a constitutional law scholar. He's dean of the College of Law at the University of Illinois. Brian Mackey is IPR's State House reporter. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Strokes are the leading cause of serious long-term disability in the U.S. Nearly one in four of those are people who have already suffered from at least one other stroke. But now, Northwestern Engineering and the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab in Chicago have teamed up to develop a new technology they're describing as a Fitbit for your whole body, and it could change how we treat stroke patients. Researchers are in the trial stages with a small flexible patch that monitors stroke patients' heart function, speech, swallowing, and more. Research scientist Megan O'Brien is on the line with us from Chicago. She's a researcher with the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Megan, this technology, how does it work? We described what it looks like, but what does it do?
Absolutely. So these are small, flexible sensors that can measure a number of different things from your body. So they can measure your heart rhythms or your muscle activity. They can measure basic movement patterns, like how much you're using your arms and legs, or how much you're walking, or standing, or sitting, or lying down. They can also measure swallowing and speech activity, so how much conversation you're having in a day, how you're swallowing different consistencies of food, which is very important for people with stroke.
Yeah, why is that important?
Also, well, a lot of people who have stroke have either aphasia or dysphagia. Now, aphasia is a communication disorder. It affects about 25 to 40% of people with stroke. And it really affects people's ability to communicate, either reading, writing, speaking, which can make it very difficult in their day-to-day life. So people with aphasia tend to, you know, maybe shut down, not talk as much. And so we want to see, using these sensors, just on a day-to-day basis, how much talking are they doing, how does our therapy affect that, and how can we improve that in the long run.
So is the idea, I guess, you obviously doctors and therapists can't be monitoring stroke patients 24 hours a day. What kind of information will these monitors help provide medical professionals with, apart from when they're not with the patients?
That's exactly right. You know, we have the technology to measure kind of each one of these things individually using equipment that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it requires teams of people, technicians, and a lot of different calibration procedures, and they're very bulky equipment. So they're really only used on a case-by-case basis or people who need constant medical monitoring. So because we don't use it for everybody, we're losing some information. We don't get all this information yet. This is the first time we're really trying to measure systematically these in-depth kind of objective measurements from people with stroke. And what that can give us is this very high-resolution data that can help us tailor our therapies to the individual. So we can see how does this treatment or how does this medication specifically affect the way their heart is working or the way their muscles are firing. And, you know, as they're undergoing therapy, what kind of interventions can we do for this person to either push them further or maybe not push them as much, just so that they get better and recover more in the long run.
And does this technology have the potential also to step in before a second stroke can occur, for example? Is there any predictive behavior we think this might give us information on?
Yes, that's absolutely a long-term goal for us. You know, we're seeing many studies are coming out with different kinds of wearables like Fitbits or Apple Watches where you can detect signs of different kinds of physical impairments, Parkinson's disease, stroke, things like that. So definitely with these sensors, because they have the capability to do long-term monitoring, we can design these state-of-the-art algorithms to look at their data in real time and say, hey, their heart is behaving differently than it should be, or something's happening with their speech. And then we can detect those things before they happen and either intervene prior to an event or get them the treatment they need as quickly as possible.
Megan, we just have about a minute left here, but I just wanted to ask you what stage you're at with this research. Is this something eventually you think will be something that will be inexpensive, that lots of patients can use? What's the goal?
The goal, you know, right now we are implementing this in a large-scale clinical trial here at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. So we want to develop this package of sensors to determine which are the most useful, which ones can we really implement in the long term, and how will that inform treatment. So eventually, we do hope to expand this not only to people with stroke, but people with other hospitalization needs, and to also monitor them out in the community after they are discharged from the hospital. So definitely in terms of the expense of the sensors, you know, they're much less expensive than anything we have right now, and this is really the first time we have the capability to measure all these things long term. So definitely we want to look at people's unified pictures of health and recovery.
Right, and then sort of see how this will be implemented in the long run. Thank you so much for being with me. Megan O'Brien is a research scientist with the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab in Chicago on this new stroke research. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting Organizing with Love in a Time of Hate, March 6th at 4 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. Author, activist, and thought leader Ai-Jen Poo will speak about the current political climate and the potential for change. cas.illinois.edu.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we wrap up our conversations with the candidates for governor. The primary is on March 20th. We've spoken to all the candidates on both sides, that is, except one candidate, our incumbent governor, Bruce Rauner. Thus far, he has declined our invitation to join him on the show, but he's welcome anytime. Just to let you know how this works, during the interviews, we asked everyone the same questions, more or less like a job interview. Robert Marshall is a physician living in Burr Ridge. He also served in the Army. He's run for office several times, most recently for Congress in 2016. He's one of six Democrats running for governor. Dr. Marshall, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Illinois went more than 2 years without a full budget. We know that most of the most vulnerable people in our state were hit hard and in many ways are still recovering. Why should voters entrust you with making sure that that doesn't happen ever again?
Well, people like that are a very high priority with me. I'm a physician. I take care of these people every day. I work at Oak Forest Hospital. That's one of the Cook County hospitals in Southern Cook County. And we take care of the poorest of the poor and the sickest of the sick. So I see these people every day. And I know what the budgetary problems are in the hospital. I also work for Roseland Hospital, which is a hospital in the southern part of Chicago, south end of Chicago. So I know and understand how these people are and how they feel. And if I'm elected, I'm not going to do anything that Rauner would do. And he's basically destroyed an awful lot of this state, not just the people who really need help, but all the rest of us too, business and things like that. So we want to avoid that if I get elected.
Let's talk taxes and how you would avoid this for a minute. This has been a prominent question as the state looks for more revenue, especially when we're looking at our individual income tax rate. Last year, we saw it go from 3.75% to 4.95%. And the corporate tax rate went up to 7%. You're the only Democrat who opposes changing our flat tax system. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I'm the only one that's opposed to a graduated income tax, and I'm also opposed to any further increase in the flat tax. I mean, 4.9% is high enough. We just had a raise, and we have to see how that increase is going to work out first before we propose any more. What I want to do is find new sources of income. Legalizing marijuana throughout the entire state, that will create a whole new industry of 30,000-40,000 new jobs and hundreds of millions of new tax revenue throughout the entire state. Another new source of income is casino gambling for Chicago. This is for the 55 million tourists who come into Chicago, and I'm the only one who... Well, I think I'm the only one who's for that because nobody else talks about it whenever we have a forum or anything. I look for new sources of revenue, and I'm opposed to any increase in the graduated tax. I put out a news release that gave 12 reasons why I'm against a graduated income tax. One of the main reasons is that how do people get into these higher income levels, like 80,000 a year family income, or 100, or 150 or 200. They get there by working hard or working a lot of hours, more than 40 hours a week. So now Mr. Pritzker and Mr. Biss and all the others are going to come to him and say, well, you have to pay a higher rate because you work harder or longer.
So what do you think it should be? What do you think the income tax rate should be?
Keep it like it is right now. I would 4.9%. Exactly. If I can, I'd like to lower it down to what it was before. I don't think we can. but just keep it like it is right now, that we just had a recent increase. Let's see how that works out. Our economy is improving slowly, you know, day by day, very, very slowly. And that by itself brings in extra revenue. You don't have to increase the rate on top of that.
So, Dr. Marshall, let me ask you, and you're talking about more revenue. Legalizing marijuana is something normally that we look at maybe providing hundreds of million dollars in revenue. Where do you look at revenue for when we're billions of dollars in the hole for not just when we're talking about our budget, but also for our pension shortfall?
Well, that's a big issue. And we do need pension reform in this state. The pensions are more than underfunded. They're actually overpromised. We have over 100,000 people who have pensions over $50,000, and the average household income is $50,000 to $60,000. That means a family has to work a whole year just to pay off one pension. I mean, that isn't the way it's paid off, but I mean, that's how they look at it. They work a whole year to pay off one pension, and there's a whole bunch of pensions above that. So we need pension reform in this state. I've proposed a radical solution.
Right. So your proposal is actually, it's a pretty unique one. You think Illinois should be split into three states. What would those states be and why would you do that?
Well, the state of Illinois, as we know now, would be dissolved. It would is a big one unified state would no longer exist politically. The Constitution and including the clause about pensions would be dissolved. Our state would be divided up into three brand new states. Chicago would be number one. The suburbs around Chicago would be number two, north of Route 80, and everything south of Route 80 would be its own state. So down where you are, everything south of Route 80 would be a brand new state with a new governor, a new constitution, and then the pensions would be divided up three ways, but they would be renegotiable. You could renegotiate them.
Right. Well, so that would divide the listening area for the show as well, because we actually have audiences north as well as south of 80. Dr. Marshall, can I ask, though, how legally you think you would be able to accomplish that within a legislature? I almost feel like that's kind of a non-starter with any elected official in the state house.
Well, if somebody ran on this issue and he won pretty decisively, the politicians would listen. I mean, as bad as they are, or bad as the state is, we are a democracy, and politicians do listen to numbers. As I go around the south part of Illinois, south of Route 80, and even up here where I live, this is very popular. People just want to have their own government, their own. They're tired of being bossed around by Chicago and the politicians from Chicago. And they want to have self-control for a change. This is very popular down in your area where I've talked to a lot of people. So no one's run on this issue that I know of. And so if I do well or win, I don't think I even have to win. If I do really, really well, the politicians are going to have to pay attention to this, you know.
Let me ask you about a couple of other issues, Dr. Marshall. Mm-hmm. One of the most controversial issues that Governor Rauner faced last year was the signing of HB 40, mm-hmm. the bill that would cover abortions for Medicaid recipients and state workers and would also keep abortions legal in Illinois should Roe versus Wade be overturned. Would you have signed that bill, and why or why not?
I've been running several times, several races, so I've been running many, many years. And I've always tried to keep my stance on abortion constant, unchanged, no matter which party I was. And it is that I want abortion to be legal with as few medical restrictions as possible, but I'm opposed to taxpayer support of abortions. You know, it has to be done privately or whatever. So I would not have signed the HB 40. Unlike Mr. Rauner, I would not have signed it. I'm maybe a little bit more like Mrs. Ives on this issue, but it's consistent with where I've always been, that abortion should be kept legal, and we should keep all these medical restrictions down to the lowest amount, but like requiring an ultrasound, or requiring a lecture, or requiring extra medical things before you have abortion, I would be against that. But I'm also against taxpayer funding of abortion, so I would not have signed HB 40.
Can I ask you also about immigration? Do you think that state resources should be used to help enforce federal immigration law when it comes to detention and deportation?
No, the federal government has plenty of resources and money and manpower to enforce their own laws. So I'm in favor of sanctuary sites for immigrants. I'm for the DACA bill. I think these people should be on a path of citizenship. These are young people, very hardworking. That's the type of people we need in this country.
Can I ask you about public education? We were talking about how, in terms of looking at funding K through 12 school funding, which is we're in the process of reforming that, but had one of the most inequitable systems in the country. Also, when we look at funding for our state universities, it's also something that we haven't put as much money into in the past couple of years. Do you think public educational institutions need more state funding?
Well, where possible. I'm opposed to a graduate tax, and I'm opposed to increasing the state tax, which I just said. We discussed that. As our economy improves and we legalize marijuana and we legalize casino gambling in Chicago, those are three big sources of new money, and that's where an awful lot of the funding should come from. I went to public schools, and my children went to public schools, so I'm a big supporter of this public school system. And I think as our economy improves, we can find places to support public school. We do need pension reform, though. You know, that's where a lot of our money is going. In all of education.
Dr. Marshall, you've obviously worked in the healthcare system as a physician. What role do you think the state government should play in making sure affordable healthcare is available to people?
Well, I'm for Obamacare. I've been campaigning that for many years. I'm for expanding Medicaid where possible under that program. And I work in that program, actually. So I know what it's like, and I know what the people are like and everything, the needs. So I think we should try to expand these programs where possible, because I do understand what's going on.
Dr. Marshall, we just have a minute or two left. I just wanted to ask you two quick questions. First, why do you want to be governor?
Well, my program is three parts, which we've already discussed. And I have this unique plan, which I think will really help the people of Illinois, of dividing it up into three states. You will have your own state down there south of Route 80. You have your own governor, and you have a new constitution, new laws, new everything, and you'll be independent of the politicians from Chicago. And you'll have your own two senators, by the way, and two electors in the Electoral College. That's a gigantic plus or a big improvement for your situation. And then up here, where I am, the suburbs, we will have our own government, our own constitution, everything, and that's good for us. And also Chicago, I think, will benefit because they can pass a lot of progressive legislation, which they can't get through the legislature in Springfield because they're much more conservative. So I think all three parts of the state would benefit from my plan.
Dr. Marshall, what's your favorite place to visit in Illinois?
Well, I like Chicago. I like Navy Pier and Millennium Park, and I like the museums. I like the museums in Chicago. You know, there's the Science Museum and the Field Museum. Those are probably my favorite in the state.
Dr. Robert Marshall is a physician. He lives in Burridge. He's also served in the Army. He's run for public office a couple of times and one of six Democrats who's running currently for governor. Dr. Marshall, thanks for being with me.
Okay, thank you.
That does it for us today. As I said, you can listen to all the candidate interviews on SoundCloud. We're going to put up a link at our website, 21stshow.org, and we're going to release a special podcast to give you a sense of who's running. Stay tuned to Twitter and Facebook for that. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. By the way, if you have a smart listening device like Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. You do have to have NPR One enabled, but all you have to do is say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can always follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on. You can also send us messages, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you want to just send us an email or leave us a voicemail, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha and Grace Stetson are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.